Okay, good afternoon. So today I'm going to continue on pipelining, and then Samir will go on to another topic about halfway through, depending on how long things take. So last time we were talking about forwarding. And forwarding was this idea that where we would otherwise not have an up-to-date value in our pipeline, we often observed that the only reason we didn't have it is because when we tried to read it from a register at some stage of the pipeline, it wasn't updated yet. But by the time we needed the value, it was computed somewhere. And we could fetch it from that other place it was computed, some other instruction that's running but not complete in our pipeline, and substitute it for the wrong value that we got from the register or somewhere else. And we had to add a mux to do this. And I'll start by reviewing a quiz question in the pre-quiz that most people missed, which was asking that when we had something like this, an IR move queue that needed to forward to, say, an add, and ask, where did the value being forwarded come from? So the way I would go about answering this question is I first say, well, where does the forwarding need to happen? And the question told you, had a choice about where the forwarding happened, just to be completely unambiguous, and it said that we would forward through the decode stage. So we would have this forwarding path here. And so that meant that there was a value being taken from the execute stage of this IR move queue instruction and being used by the decode stage of this add queue instruction in place of the value it would otherwise read from the register file. And this value is this 50. And that 50 originally came from the instruction memory, but it's not there anymore because we're fetching another instruction right now. So it's not currently the output of the instruction memory. It was the input to the pipeline registers between fetch and decode, but it's not there anymore because that's where add queue is. So now it was in the registers that were between decode and execute. It's being output by those registers that were between decode and execute. So it was passed all the way from fetch. And it's being input to the registers between execute and memory. So the place where the value is coming from to be input into the mux that's in the add state, adds instruction, is the pipeline registers between decode and execute. It's being input into the execute and to memory registers, but it's not stored in those yet, and you can't read those registers to get it. And that's what the correct answer was. So any questions about this? People seem somewhat confused. So that was that quiz question. And the mux registers look something like this. This time I have drawn this picture with this line in the correct place. So we have something which is being passed through the execute stage, going to the next stage, and we have this shortcut here where we can substitute it using these muxes for a register value. And part of your job is to have the correct control when you're doing it. And when we have our processor, we have many cases where we're going to need to do this. And your job in future assignments is going to be to figure these all out and to write the HCL code that implements all of these paths, all these cases where we might need to forward. And the basic procedure is that you're going to look and say, is the register of this instruction that's in the pipeline writing to the one we're trying to use? And if it is, I need to use that value instead of another. So the basic form is going to be that you're going to say, okay, am I trying to read the same register that some future pipeline stage is writing to? If so, use the value that future pipeline stage has that is going to write to that register at some point in the future. And if not, you do the usual thing. For example, taking the value from the register file. And a very tedious part of this is making sure that you actually handle all the cases in these dot, dot, dot that you need to handle in order to not be missing anything that might be written to a register in the future. This means you might need to handle some special cases, some weird cases that you might not have thought of unless you're exhaustive about where can every type of instruction be, thing that needs to write to a register, be in the pipeline when I'm trying to read. Yeah. So you need to account for you need to know about every future pipeline stage, and you should think, so my procedure would be, okay, I'm reading from this register, could an instruction that's writing to it be in execute? If so, what should I do? Could an instruction that's writing to this register be in memory? If so, what should I do? Could an instruction that's writing to this register be in write back? If so, what should I do? And a subtlety is that we have some instructions with write to two registers, and you need to handle, could the instruction that's writing to the first register I'm using be in execute memory write back? Could an instruction that's writing to the second register I'm using, the second register it writes to, be in execute memory write back? If you remember, the only instructions that write to two registers were push and pop, but yes, you need to implement forwarding for RSP. So the stack pointer is something we might need to forward the additions and subtractions of. And after we implement all this forwarding, we're left with one case that we didn't quite handle. And that's this. So here, we want this RBX value that comes from memory, and we want to use it in this subtract, let's say. And we can't. Because if we just do the natural thing, we have the value available after memory. This is the soonest we can get this value. It doesn't exist earlier. Like, yeah, you might want to forward it after execute, but it's not there yet. So this is the soonest we can get the value, and it's too late. We can't do the subtraction anymore. It's at the end of the cycle. You know, it's too late to forward that value. So in this case, yeah.
So why is it there any backwards, like, why can't you feed it directly into
MUX? What would we want to do? So in this case, you want to, so we have the value that's being output in memory. Where do you want to make it go?
As an input to MUX.
So we could have it be an input to MUX, but usually when we draw this forwarding path into the ALU.
Right.
So yeah, so we could put a MUX in front of the ALU. So in this case, this is something which would result in the correct operation of our processor. It would obey the instruction set architecture. So can anyone think of what is a reason we wouldn't want to do this, even though it would be correct? Go ahead.
You said stall like until.
So the solution I'm going to do is stalling, but it would be correct to, like this suggestion, to just put a MUX in front of our ALU and possibly forward it right to the ALU. Like, conceptually draw this line a little bit backwards in front of execute.
Can you go back in time?
So this wouldn't be going back in time since it's the same cycle, but it would have a related problem.
So does it, you have to wait until the end of the memory cycle, right? So you have to wait till that wire, stabilizes mm-hmm. one value, and then that would send it to the ALU, and then it would.
Yeah. So.
So
conceptually, in order for this to complete, we need to wait for the. In the worst case, we're gonna need to wait for the memory to complete reading the value, and then for the ALU to do its computation. So this, and we could do that, but in order for that to happen, we're gonna need to make our clock cycle long enough to hold an ALU operation and a memory operation. And not doing this was the primary reason we don't have an execute plus memory stage, but we have an execute stage and a memory stage. So it's going to make our processor a lot slower if we do that. So while we could do that, it would make our processor a ton slower because our cycle length would be based on how long does it take to access memory and do an ALU operation. And so we're going to not do that just to avoid that extra long cycle time. And we could do similar things that compromise our cycle time. And we know this because we have a single cycle version of our processor. Like, we could do all the work of the instruction in a single cycle. But we don't want to compromise our small cycle time that gives us good pipelining performance, just to handle some special cases, which is what we'd be doing in that case. And so because we don't want to make the cycle time that long, this forwarding path is not going to be one we're going to do. You know, when we do forwarding between memory and execute, we want that forwarding to just be from the thing at something value that's available near the end of the memory stage right into a pipeline register between execute and memory. Because there's not going to be any extra work that's going to make our cycle much longer. And because we're not going to be allowed to do this to keep our cycle length reasonable, we're going to stall. And this is the one case where our processor stalls besides RET. So we stall for RET, and we stall for what our book calls a load use hazard. Everything else, we're not going to stall. For conditional jumps, we're going to do branch prediction. So we're going to try to do something. It might turn out to be wasted work, but we're going to optimistically try to do something. And every other case, we handle with forwarding. All those data hazards we're going to be able to handle with forwarding. I leave it as an exercise to figure out that we can, in fact, do this.
So just to reiterate, we only stall for RET and this load use hazard.
Yeah.
That's it.
And that this is possible is one of the reasons why our book chose these particular stages. Like, they knew that that allowed this. And it's a particularly nice design. It's very similar to the design of the early MIPS processors, which is probably where the book's authors came up with this way of dividing up the pipeline work. Yeah?
Like, what year in time are we as far as, like, state-of-the-art?
What year in time are we as far as state-of-the-art? Samira, do you know, when was MIPS 1? Is that 80s? Yeah, so probably. Okay. Yeah, so 70s or 80s. Yeah.
I heard from some of the TAs that, like, state-of-the-art processors today, they have even different stages than these stages that we talked about.
Yes, Samira will probably allude to what state-of-the-art processors do, which is also surprisingly old. Like, all those ideas are like 60s.
How many stages do current processors have?
So how many stages do current processors have is the question. It's like 10 to 15 counting stages in current processors is surprisingly ambiguous, but it's probably like 10 to 15. Okay. And another thing I'd like to mention is that there are sometimes multiple forwarding paths. I'm not sure if I got to this last time, but just to remind you, sometimes there are multiple ways to forward. So here, we are using R8 over and over again. And we could forward from the end of memory to the end of decode here. The value from R8 from here to here. And, you know, that gives us a more up-to-date version of R8 than we'd read from the register file, but it's wrong. And you should be aware of this because this is a bug that you are likely to make. Is using an out-of-date version of R8 that is forwarded, but not the best version you could have forwarded. So when you handle that, this is why HCL2D has MUXs work in check in order for the conditions. So you should just make sure that you order your MUXs correctly for that, and it will handle the rest. Also, sometimes it happens that you'll be forwarding multiple things, and you actually need to forward multiple values to an instruction. So this add R12 R8 needs forwarding in the same cycle from two different instructions. That's normal. That's something you better allow, because you need both R12 and R8 to have the correct value. Okay. So any questions about sort of overall forwarding prediction stuff? Yeah.
So when you're saying it's put them in the right order to make sure they're not holding like an old an old value, would that mean that you would need to check for like the earliest that you could, or like not like one of the earlier stages first and then keep checking to see like is it an executed state?
Yes. So the idea would be that, yeah, you check for, like, is it an execute? Do I want to forward from execute first? Because the instruction in execute is closer in the program to the one you care about, the one you're executing now when you're doing this forwarding decision. So you have execute first, then check for it in memory if you didn't find it in execute. You want to check in order from closest to the instruction you're executing, getting the value forwarded to farthest. If you check in the wrong order, there's going to be this bug, which only sometimes happens, where you sometimes have the wrong, give it the wrong value. But only in cases where you use the same register like three times in a row, not in other cases. So you might not come across it in testing. We might. So be aware of it. Okay, so after we do all this forwarding and we do stalling for ret and we do this branch prediction and squashing, so we only need to stall in two places. So memory output needed in execute, which is like mRemove Q or pop Q, followed by anything which uses the register that was written to, besides RSP for pop Q, and ret. Those are the only cases we stall. So our processor is pretty close, actually, to our sort of ideal for pipelining of that we execute about one instruction per cycle. That's sort of the long run view. Every instruction is taking 5 cycles to execute for real, but in most typical programs, you know, we're not going to have a huge number of returns. You know, maybe a couple percent of our program is returns, maybe more than that, but probably not more than like 10%. And we're not going to have a huge number of these bit problems. And moreover, a smart compiler can deliberately avoid generating these load use hazards. And real compilers do things like that. They say, I know that this processor doesn't like me using a value, the instruction after I load it. Therefore, I'm going to try to do something else after the load. And the result is that we're very close to sort of our ideal performance for pipelining by splitting up into 5 pieces. We do have some additional costs. So we solved our data hazards with forwarding, and that involves like adding lots of wires, which seem, and lots of muxes. Those muxes aren't super expensive, but it's possible that that's gonna slightly slow down our processor, but it's definitely worth it. Because we're getting rid of like multiple cycles of stalling by adding all this forwarding logic, and it often isn't even on the critical path. Like if the memory stage is slowest, then any forwarding logic that only touches the execute and decode stages probably doesn't make our processor slower. And so all modern processors generally implement every single possible forwarding path. Well, all modern sort of pipeline processors do. Other designs do something, might not do every forwarding path. But when you're anyone who did this sort of pipeline processor pretty much always implements all the forwarding paths, even if it seems like it's inconvenient, because it's so worth doing. Okay, so another quiz question that some people were confused by is dependencies versus hazards. So a dependency is instruction X needs the result of instruction Y. You can tell if there's a dependency because some value is shared between the two things, or some logical thing is shared. And this is a property of our instruction set. So two instructions depend on each other, have a dependency, regardless of whether they are actually going to interfere in something like a pipeline implementation. We can talk about dependencies even with a single cycle processor. hazard is, will it not work in some pipeline? And this is before we do any extra work to deal with hazards. So before we do any stalling logic, any branch prediction, to deal with the problem, is there a problem in a pipe, in a particular pipeline? So when we talk about hazards, we're talking about a particular pipeline. And this means that if we talk about a different pipeline, it's going to have different hazards. So for example, a three-stage pipeline will have many fewer hazards than our five-stage pipeline, just because fewer instructions can be in the pipeline at the same time to interfere with each other. And so with that, here's a little exercise. So here's a sequence of instructions. And why don't you write down where all the dependencies are between these instructions, and which of those dependencies are hazards in our pipeline that we can resolve with forwarding, or can't resolve with forwarding. And I would suggest writing something down, but if you don't want to do that, I'm not going to stop you. And when you've written them down, hopefully, I would suggest comparing with your neighbor to see if you agree, especially on which ones are actually hazards in our pipeline. Okay, so who thinks they've found almost all the dependencies and hazards and knows what they are? Some more? Who thinks they found at least like half of them? Okay, so most people who thinks they haven't found anything and was looking, okay, or hasn't found half of them, needs more time. A couple people, but not, okay. So I think a majority of people got somewhere. So the way I go about this is I first look for the dependencies, and you can do this systematically. So I say, okay, this add queue instruction, it writes RBX. So let's see if anyone is using RBX. And I see, oh, yep, someone is. So that's a dependency of the add queue instruction. So then I can ask, is this dependency a hazard? So when this instruction is in its decode stage, this instruction is in execute, memory, write back, and this add queue here is out of the pipeline. So it's written to its register properly. So it is not a hazard in our five-stage pipeline. And I can keep doing this procedure. So then I look at this subqueue, and I see, okay, it's writing to RCX. Is that used somewhere else later on? And I say, okay, there's this IRemove queue here. And it writes to RCX. It does not read RCX, so that is not a dependency. Common error is to say, oh, they're writing the same register, it's a dependency. It is not a dependency. There's no dependency here, even though it's the same register. Just like there's no dependency between the add queue and the sub queue, even though they both read from RAX. Like, that's not a problem. They can both read that value without depending on each other's results. Then I can look down at IRemove queue and say, it writes to RCX. Does someone use that value it writes to? I didn't look at subqueue and add queue because I saw, oh, it writes to IRemove queue, wrote to RCX, therefore the value from subqueue went away. But add queue wrote to RCX. Sorry, add queue reads from RCX after IRemove queue writes to it, so that is a dependency. And we know that at the time that add queue is reading from RCX in the decode stage, this IRemove queue is in the execute stage. It hasn't done its write back yet. It's not finished. So it must be a hazard. And we know, in fact, that we can resolve this with forwarding because the value that IRemove queue is writing is available in execute. Yes?
Can you review why it's not a dependency from the second RCX?
So the question was, can you explain why subqueue to IRemove queue was not a dependency?
No, the subqueue to add queue.
Subqueue to add queue. So why is that not a dependency? Because yes, we're writing to RCX, but what subqueue writes to RCX doesn't matter at all after the IRemove queue. It could have written anything, and it won't affect anything afterwards. Yeah.
So like, how would you have to in IRemove queue like kind of overwrite anything that would have like preemptive measures you would take in
subqueue? So if we were for forwarding, this is not going to be a. So the question is, do we have to like do something special because we might have done something to handle the hazard based on subqueue and add queue being together, and that would be messed up by IRemove queue. So for forwarding, this won't be a problem because we will forward from IRemove queue instead. So as long as you handle that double forwarding case correctly, this is fine. But there are other things you might do to handle pipeline hazards where this is a problem that we will not do in this class, but they happen in real processors. This is known as the write after write problem. So this was a dependency which is resolved with forwarding. And we can keep going down. So add queue, it writes to R10. We can say, is R10 read later? And in the following add queue does that. So that is a dependency. And we know that this write doesn't happen in time for the decode stage of the last add queue. So it's also a hazard. And we know we can resolve this with forwarding because the new value is computed at the end of execute and needed by the end of decode, and that's fine. So any questions? Yeah.
So just as a guideline, in order to see if there are any dependencies, you basically should look four lines down from an instruction.
See if there are any hazards, you should look. For dependencies, you need to look infinitely far. Because dependencies do not care how long the pipeline is. It doesn't matter what the pipeline is, or even if there is one. For hazards, you only need to look four ahead for our five-stage pipeline. Yes.
So say constant 100 replaced with RCX, then would IR be dependent on sub and add be dependent on IR?
So if this was an RO move queue, RCX to RCX.
Yeah.
So usually the way we talk about that is we'd say that that the RO move queue RCX to RCX depends on the sub queue, and the add queue only depends on the RO move queue. It's usually how we'd phrase it, and they're like there's a transitive dependency, but we're just talking about direct dependencies in this case.
So
add would be dependent on an IR move queue, which would be dependent on an RR move queue, which would be dependent on sub, but we wouldn't say add and sub are directly dependent on each other. Yeah.
So you said we can resolve IR move queue and add by forwarding.
Yeah.
But then you just talked about load use case, how you can't just forward. So would that still be considered forwarding?
So the question is about, is this the load use thing we need to stall for? So when I say load, I mean load from data memory. Because the problem is that something happens in the memory stage that computes our value, and we wanted it by execute of the next instruction. So this is not that case. Even though it comes from the instruction memory, that's fine. That's in the fetch stage. It's fetched plenty early, so we don't need to stall. Okay, so in this class we'll spend most of our time dealing with one particular pipeline, but different pipelines exist and you should be able to reason about how that affects things. And different pipelines are going to have different hazards. So for example, let's say we had an execute plus memory stage instead of an execute stage and a memory stage. Then something which would be a hazard before would not be a hazard anymore. So this R8 to R8 dependency is a dependency in all cases because it doesn't matter what pipeline we're using. But with a four-stage pipeline, it's not a hazard. You're done with the write back between this add and AND instructions. We're done with the write back for the add by the time the AND needs to do its decode. With a five-stage pipeline, it is a problem and we do need forwarding. So
as a general rule, for like an end stage pipeline, the most instructions ahead that you could have a hazard is n minus one.
Yeah, for ignoring, yeah, that's the general rule. The way I would reason about this is not trying to memorize a rule like that, but doing this sort of work here.
Oh.
It depends where the decode is, right?
Yeah.
But I just do this sort of work. Like, if I'm here and I need to read a value, what is happening elsewhere in the pipeline? And I'll finish up here. So briefly, I'll skip some. And briefly talk a little bit about debugging pipelines in HCLTD. And I'm mentioning this because this is a big sink of TA time in the past, and we would like it to be less of a sink, so we'd like you to be able to better help yourselves. So my general advice for pipeline debugging, the first thing you should do is you should draw the state of the instructions in the pipeline. You should draw this diagram of what's of fetch, decode, execute, memory, write back for each instruction, and figure out where like things like forwarding are supposed to happen. What's in what stage? If you don't do this, it is way, way harder to reason about anything. At least for me. Maybe you are different, but this is always when people come to my office hours, that basically the first thing I tell them to do. You should get the output from dash D, which tells you what's on every wire, where did it come from. I would recommend redirecting it to a file, because you probably want to like scroll up and down in it to see what happens in different cycles, and that's really awkward to do in a terminal that you're also trying to type commands in. You should systematically check each stage of the instruction that you think is broken. Like what happens in fetch? Like look at its values in pipeline registers. Is it right? And go through each stage and see where you see the first thing that looks wrong. And expect forwarding hazarding problems. And another piece of note besides reiterating draw the pipeline stages is you can write your own test cases. And this is good because our test cases might have extra stuff going on. That's confusing. So if you want to know whether an instruction is a part of the problem, copy the test case, replace it with a NOP, and see if it's still a problem. Okay, and I will turn it over to Samira. So one note while we're doing technical transition. So my impression is that there's probably too much stuff in this week's lab. And probably the reason we didn't know this before is because in past semesters it was at least seemed more like we were grading labs very loosely compared to this semester where we're also grading labs loosely, but it seemed even more so. So do people think that they would have been happier if I moved like the first two instructions in the lab to the homework that was due on Wednesday? Yes? Absolutely not. What? So,
are you saying like?
So in the lab, so this lab is a lot more work than the previous lab. Yeah. And some people apparently found it to take a very long time. And yeah, so.
Did it take all of lab time or did it take longer?
Some people claim it takes substantially longer than the lab time to finish, which I can believe would happen sometimes if you like found a bug or something. I want to know, do people, so I guess, so another question is, how many people finished all of the lab in less than 75 minutes? How many people took substantially more than 75 minutes? Okay. It should be reasonable to finish the lab in 75 minutes, is what I'm saying. If it's not, I should consider adjusting the lab to be a little shorter. I don't expect everyone to, but if like half the class isn't, that's an indication just for future semesters, we might want to move some stuff like to the previous homework to make it so the lab actually kind of fits in 75 minutes.
Were we supposed to submit the entire thing by yesterday night, or?
You're supposed to submit something, what you had.
Okay.
We will generally grade labs on leniently enough that we think that if you spent 75 minutes on it, you should get full credit. So you need to make some progress. Like, we don't want you to submit this file you started with like, with like things from the lab pasted in and that's it. But if you make some progress, you should get full credit. But we might like, you know, if we get something where we look at it where it's like, did you do anything? That's a problem. Okay.